Spirit Radio Podcasts.
Our next guest is originally from Limerick, but has spent much of her life in Africa. Her work as an obstetrician in Uganda and also in the field of HIV/AIDS prevention and care was recognised back in Ireland when she received a Presidential Distinguished Service Award in 2015. She founded a programme called Youth Alive in an effort to address the root causes for the spread of HIV and to help young people to make responsible choices and avoid getting AIDS. This prevention program was remarkably successful in Uganda and has now been extended to a number of other African countries. In studio now to share about her life and work, we have Franciscan Missionary Sister for Africa, Miriam Duggan. You are very welcome to the show, Sister Miriam.
Thank you very much.
First of all, Sister Miriam, how did you find your way into the dual vocation of being a medical doctor and a religious sister?
Well, I joined to be a religious sister. I had no idea of doing medicine then, but at that time, when I was finished my formation course with the Franciscan Missionary Sisters, I was asked if I would go on and do medicine, because at the time it was during the Mau Mau trouble in Kenya, and doctors who had families had come home and left, and so there was kind of an SOS, please send sisters to train as doctors. And I happened to have Latin in my leaving cert, and that was a requirement to enter for medical school in those days, and that's how I ended up
doing
medicine.
Wow. And obviously you were whip smart, as they say, in these parts. So what do you think were the challenges that you faced when you started working initially as an obstetrician in Uganda? First of all, being a woman, was that relatively unusual?
It was, and probably was unusual even to have obstetricians, gynecologists in those days.
At all?
Very few. In Uganda at the time. And there were many challenges. Like, I came from a situation where I'd done postgraduate training, and you always had people around you and people above you and guiding you. And you suddenly find you're alone. You don't even have another doctor to assist you. So that was probably one of the biggest challenges, just learning to get on with it and to trust in your own intuition.
In your own intuition. I would absolutely, like, kind of back yourself and go, no, I know what this is. And I would imagine, too, like, in some traditional societies where there's an awful lot of folk wisdom around things like reproduction and health and that kind of stuff, that actually you come in with a lot of new stuff. Did you get any pushback on that? Was there any resistance at all?
No, there wasn't, because my first appointment was in Uganda, and people there, they treasure having children very much. I mean, if you don't have children, there must be something wrong with you.
Yeah.
And so they're very keen. They look upon children as their treasures, really, and their wealth.
Yeah.
So it was a very joyous time, really. But on the other hand, because you saw many emergencies there that you wouldn't see back here in Ireland, because people were often in labour for days and days in the village, and they'd come in with ruptured wombs and
in real trouble. Yeah.
So that was very much new to me as well.
Yeah. So you were getting people really. You weren't getting a kind of a general kind of population of people having babies. You were getting people who were already in trouble that the local midwife hadn't been able to handle or whatever. Yeah. That must have been quite a challenge. And I'm thinking over the 30 years, you know, that you were working in that area, were there massive improvements?
Pardon?
Were there massive improvements?
I think there was, because we had a training school for midwives as well, and I think we brought that standard up quite a bit. And then part of my work too was training other local doctors in obstetrics and gynecology as well.
When I was speaking to you last in 2012, Sister Miriam, we were talking about the way Uganda faced this massive HIV crisis in the 90s, in the 1980s actually. Can you tell us how Uganda took a different approach to other countries? Because it was a different approach, wasn't it?
It was very different, yes. I suppose, for myself anyway, that when I saw what was happening and people were coming in and saying the condom was the answer, and as a gynecologist, I knew the condom might reduce the risk, but it wasn't total prevention. And we started this program, Education for Life, a behavior change program, with Sister Kay Lawler, who was a medical mission sister, and myself, who kind of put it together. And then we used that program to help people to look at their lifestyle, where they were taking risks, and to see what did they want in life, and then to make the changes that were necessary. It was like a behavior change process. And it really took off around the country. And then the president came out and supported us. I don't know if you remember when he spoke at a conference in Florence. He made that very important quote that went all around the world, right? He said, you know, now they're telling us our lives hangs between a piece of rubber and death. And he said, but that is why I'm asking my people to go back to our time-tested culture of no sex before marriage and faithfulness in marriage, which is the value that is in Africa.
Yeah, and what was extraordinary about it was like as though nobody had ever dared say that at the time. Mm. That was what was such a radical thing. It was the reason it was beamed everywhere was because he was saying, you know, almost the kind of obvious, most obvious thing in the world, which is basically if you don't sleep around, I think the word you used was grazing. Was that the word that you used at the time?
Yes.
The idea that the idea of moving from person to person, that it's not going to spread if that doesn't happen. And that really is...
And then he said young people need to be taught discipline, self-control and at times sacrifice. I mean, they were very powerful words coming from an African president at a European conference.
It was. I remember it well. But what was interesting was he was coming with the authority of having tried it and it having worked. Because everybody else was going, don't be ridiculous, that's never going to work. Mm-hmm. But it did work, didn't it?
It did, yes.
So tell us about that.
At one stage, Kampala was known as the AIDS capital of the world, and it was true. We were seeing deaths every day. And because at that time, there were no ARVs either. And the prevalence rate among young adults, young people, was 28%. And within the matter of a few years, that came down to 6%.
Extraordinary.
Yeah. You
know, isn't it amazing?
And no other method around the world was able to... put it. Even people who were cynical in the beginning began to see that it can work if you have the right motivation and the right...
And of course, once you've made it work, then you have the statistics, you have you know, all the metrics, you're able to show people, and the people who are, the people who are cynical and kind of sceptical that it will work. Mm. And it kind of, other people came and said, can you show us how to do this, didn't they?
Yeah, I went to many African countries afterwards training people in the programme.
Yeah.
And thank God. And then we set up the Youth Alive Clubs as kind of ongoing support for young people and where we, just to keep the attitude alive.
And what was their response?
The response is great because in several schools in Uganda, and I know in Zambia as well and in Zimbabwe, they have Youth Alive Clubs. And they make that commitment that they wait to have sex until they're ready for marriage.
Now, you're back in Ireland now, and up to this January, all obstetricians in Ireland were expected to care for two patients, the mother and the unborn baby. Well, I mean, I'm asking you an obvious question, but you know, does it sadden you that this has now changed?
It does sadden me very much, because I think it was something that, in my day anyway of training, it was drilled into us that we had two people on our hands, right? And that you... And, you know, I'm surprised that it actually went through in Ireland. For myself, working even in with very premature help available, I've never had to take the life of a baby to save the life of a mother.
Ever?
No.
In my entire career?
But I've had to stay up night after night caring for somebody or really investing a lot of time in people. And sometimes we've had to induce labour a bit prematurely.
Yeah.
But when the baby was viable. But I've never had to, thank God, I've never been in a situation.
I mean, isn't that extraordinary that there you are speaking? Now, I'm not saying that nobody else, you know, that there aren't other people out there, but there was an awful lot of store placed on this being something that was going to come up, not regularly, but sufficiently regularly to need to be, you know, to change legislation, to change the constitution, all the rest. And you're saying that in your entire life and the, you know, an entire career of working as an obstetrician, it just didn't come up.
No, I mean, we did have difficult cases.
I mean, it could have come up. Yeah. Again, I suppose you could ask the question that there another set of eyes on some of the things you saw might have gone, we should abort this baby maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Is that possible? Another set of eyes other than yours might have gone.
Probably, but yeah. I think as well that many times we really prayed for somebody to bring them to viability, you know, before we'd have to intervene.
Exactly, and of course the power of prayer. You know, we forget that too, don't we? Do you think obstetricians who have a conscientious objection to carrying out abortions will be respected and protected in the Irish Health Service?
Well, they should be protected if we have freedom of religious. when I worked in England, they had passed the abortion bill there in 1967, and I was doing my postgraduate work there at the time, and they respected me there even when I had a conscientious objection. And even one time I went for an interview for a higher post, like it was a registrar's post, and I was surprised to get the job because there were quite a few applying for the job. And I asked afterwards one of the consultants why, and he said, you know, because I felt that was against me because I wouldn't do abortions, and I was quite upfront about it. And they said, well, we recognise that you had principles and you were brave to stand by them. And that's what consultants need.
Absolutely. Yeah, well, that's not the truth. I'm wondering if there are people now who are going into medicine, young people going into medicine, and they kind of, particularly if they have a kind of a pro-life bent of their feeling is towards that, and I imagine many doctors do. That's why they're doctors. But they look at this area, you know, of obstetrics and go, nah, it'd be too hard. Would you encourage them to go into it anyway?
I would still encourage them to go into it, but to have the courage to stand firm. And people will come to them if they do that, because I think once you have that value of life, you won't mind getting up late at night or staying up or answering a midnight call to save somebody's life or to save another baby's life. So I think to me there's an awful risk that you use the value of life once you begin to take life.
Absolutely. What things give you hope today?
Many of the good things I see around me. I work in a very poor situation, but I've been fascinated by the care the poor people have for each other. And, you know, that gives me great hope. I'm working on a program that's with drug addicts, and because I'm not any longer doing obstetrics and gynecology, my age doesn't allow me to do that. But I'm working with drug addicts and people who are in difficulties, and we do a rehabilitation program with them. And then we sponsor them in to do skill training. And it's to see them making that U-turn and coming out of antisocial behaviour and putting their life straight and making it in life and getting a good job. And that, you know, gives me great hope.
Absolutely. Well, listen, Sister Miriam Duggan, it is absolutely a pleasure and a gift for us that to meet you again. That's probably been 8 years and then some since I spoke to you last. It's been lovely, lovely to meet you. Franciscan missionary sister and obstetrician, Miriam Duggan. God bless you.
God bless you. Thank you very much.
There's an interesting line in one of St. Peter's letters. It says, always be ready to give an answer to anyone who calls you to account for the hope that is in you. Yet do it with gentleness and reverence. And I suppose St. Paul would have said with a hint or with a pinch of wit. And that theme, always be ready to give an answer, is the focus of this year's Ecumenical Bible Week, which takes place in the Dublin, Kildare, Wicklow area this week. The week features a wide range of talks and discussions. And on the line to tell us more, we have one of the organisers of Bible Week, Jared Gallagher. How are you doing, Jared?
Good morning, Ronan. How are you?
Great. From the Office of Evangelization and Ecumenism at the Catholic Archdiocese of Dublin, you're very welcome to the show. First of all, Jared, can you remind us, what is Bible Week?
Bible Week is a very simple idea. It started 6 years ago, and it began with a conversation between the Church of Ireland and the Catholic Archdiocese after applying championship, saying how we can continue to work together. So what we came up with was the one area of commonality that we all have in all the churches is the proclamation of the gospel. So we came up with a little program around Bible Week in parishes, some central events, but actually working together. So we have the Church of Ireland with the Catholic Diocese here in Dublin. We have the Lutherans, Methodist, you know, the Society of Friends. We have many, many different evangelical alliances are all involved in this.
Brilliant.
In some shape or form.
It's fantastic.
It's radical.
It's really radical. Yeah, fantastic. Yeah. And that idea, as you say,
imagine working together.
Yeah, just imagine. So how has it been going so far?
It's been very interesting. We started on Monday morning with a prayer breakfast, and we took the line from John's Gospel, come and have breakfast, words of Jesus. So we had breakfast in St. Paul's Church. We had about 20, 25 people gathered together, and we reflected just on the gospel. We had prayer. We had Sean Mullen, who runs Third Space.
Brilliant.
We had Brian Chartle, the Capuchin.
Wow. Fantastic.
And, just
yeah.
speaking on the word and praying together. That was lovely. And then Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday night of this week, we have events in different parts of the city, county, you know, looking at different questions. Like, for example, like tonight in Hoth, they're looking at the question, Rachel Bewley Bateman is looking at the question, who is my neighbour? Yeah. That's in the Church of Ireland parish. You know, right. Lessington, Kieran O'Mahony is speaking about Luke's teaching on prayer and on the Lord's Prayer. So that's very topical this week whenever Pope Francis has kind of suggested a change even to the language of the Lord's Prayer. And so we have kind of little events in parishes, but we'll notice this year our numbers are actually up in all our parish venues. Probably because they're going to parishes that there is scripture groups, prayer groups, Bible study, Lectio Divina groups happening. So it's actually building on, you know, good framework and support in some of these parishes where people gather to pray, but also to study and, you know, find out more about their faith.
So when you have something like this that's kind of in there, in the kind of churchy air, as it were, it kind of almost creates it's almost like a substructure that kind of people can build on from year to year and go, oh, that thing's coming around again. And actually, yeah. it almost lends energy almost to the parishes to do something around it, doesn't
yeah,
it?
And it's kind of like a soft ecumenism. You know, it's people locally, you know, in three or four different kinds of Christian denominations working together on a program.
Yes,
and that's lovely, you know, because they realize what they have in common is greater than what, you know, separates
or
divides them or whatever.
Absolutely, yeah,
And for example, like tomorrow night we have kind of two core events on Thursday here. We have a symposium on the afternoon, which is a paid-in event. So we have Patricia McGlinchey from the Church of Ireland, Patricia Devlin, Catholic, Sir Geoffrey Donaldson, MEP, from the Member of Parliament.
How'd you get him?
Archbishop Michael Jackson.
That's brilliant. All the stars.
There's no borders in the church in Ireland.
That's like, fantastic.
We're 26, you know, so the key thing is they're looking at this question, how can you be Christian in Ireland today? So voices of hope in a secularized Ireland. So
wow.
They speak from their own personal faith. We have our Thinking Aloud Then event in the evening time, which just is an open ticket. So we have leaders of the churches together. So we have Archbishop Dermot Martin at that. We have Bishop Pat Story, with Jules Hamilton, the Methodist chaplain in Trinity, and with people from the Evangelical Alliance, just reflecting on the question of what does it mean to be Christian in Ireland today. So we're really taking that phrase that you quoted at the beginning about always prepared to give an answer. We're really bringing it and stretching it. So those two events tomorrow are here in Holy Cross College in Clonliffe. And if you don't know where Clonliffe is, it's beside Crow Park and the Dogs.
Exactly.
You know where that is.
just look for the big building on the north side.
Right. So, if you're actually interested in this tension around how you can continue to be Christian in modern Ireland, and if you're free in the afternoon or free in the evening, two very, very good events to come to.
So that's the 2 p.m. symposium, How to Be a Christian in Ireland Today. That's in Clonliffe.
They're both in the same venue. So you can come to both or you can come to one or the other.
And then 7:30 p.m. Thinking Aloud.
Yeah. And then, like, for example, like next Sunday, which is Trinity Sunday, we finish over in the Lutheran Chapel there on Adelaide Road. And we do the Lutheran Vespers. We kind of
wow.
sing them.
Wow.
And they're lovely. And Sam Winnie, I have to get his pronunciation correct.
He's
good at it.
Yeah.
So there's a little bit of everybody kind of appearing in the program at different points. You know, there's music, there's reflection, you know, there's thinking aloud, you know, there's ways that you can approach, but actually all kind of geared towards that phrase, how can you give an answer? And getting each and every one of us to reflect on what are the answers that we need to give in modern Ireland today.
It's a really, really good theme, I have to say, and it's clever. Tell us how you kind of came up with it and what it means in terms of how it's been seen within the context of the organisation.
Well, probably in about 2 or 3 months' time, we'll get together and we'll kind of scratch heads and we'll just have coffee conversation and say, well, what topic and theme do we go for next year? And we do this in the context of prayer. And gradually a theme will emerge. You know, like 2 years ago, we reflected on, you know, that papal encyclical Laudato Si on environment issues and being Christian. So gradually something will come to the fore. But this year, there's a lot of debate around, you know, social and church and faith issues in society. So maybe that's why we're always being ready today to give an answer, because quite a lot of our congregations and communities of faith and prayer groups and people probably don't know what answers to give. And as a result of not knowing the answer, they kind of just say nothing.
Yeah.
So what we're trying to do is encourage people to kind of just raise up a voice. And if you have something to say, that if we are a pluralist or a secular Ireland, well, then our Christian voices have a role to play within this, you know, context of that.
Absolutely. It's such a good theme and such a good idea, I must say. So how can people find out more?
Well, there's two ways you can do it. One, we have BibleWeek.ie, which is a website. on that website, you can automatically link to our social media. So, you know, that can track it into your phone and you can find out exactly where it is. And there's little maps. If you don't know where the venues are, they'll bring you to the different places. So, for example, like tonight, there's something in Howth, there's something in Rathfarnham area, there's something in the Clontarf area, there's something in Blessington. So even if you only think of those four areas, you'll find out something in those areas. And then tomorrow, it's in Clonliffe, which is Dublin 3, or in the Drumcondra side of Dublin. And then on Sunday, it's out on Adelaide Road. So bibleweek.ie is the website, and there's social media driven behind that as well. And the local parishes should have some information as well, any of those that are hosting things.
Brilliant. So bibleweek.ie is kind of, if you can go there, it'll give
that's
you a little extra.
You'll get everything.
Yeah, yeah, brilliant. Gerard Gallagher, thank you so much for joining us this morning. It's Gerard Gallagher from the Office of Evangelization and Ecumenism at the Catholic Archdiocese of Dublin. God bless you, man.
God bless you.
Well there. Our Prayer Coach series continues today. It's where we get to talk about spiritual health and how we can get better at praying and getting close to God. And this morning, we are delighted to have back in studio Reverend Baden Stanley from Christchurch in Bray, County Wicklow, and we're going to talk about mystery. You're very welcome to the show, Baden.
Thanks very much, Ronan. Good to see you again.
Absolutely. First of all, Baden, in our modern age, we're not really comfortable with the idea of mystery, are we?
It's an amazing thing, isn't it? We like to know our facts. We like to know our context. A lot more focus and energy is put into the detail of things, whereas before, in maybe simpler times, maybe not, we might just remember them that way. You could just accept things or you could just work with things. But I think it's not just that sense that we're not comfortable with that sense of mystery. I think it's actually that sense that we don't like not to know.
Exactly.
I think we have that sense of we are somehow more sophisticated than we used to be.
Exactly.
So we should know everything now.
And is that something to do with control, do you think?
Oh, definitely, yeah. I mean, I think for many of us anyway, certainly for myself, it can feel like life is spiraling the whole time. So, I mean, when everything else is spiraling and spinning, we try to find what can we control.
Absolutely.
What can we hold on to?
You know, it's funny you say that, because even in my own way, I find that now that we have our smartphones,
yes,
I find myself reaching for the smartphone a lot just to find out things.
Yes, that's right. Information seems like power.
It does.
But actually, sometimes there's a little twist in the tail of that, because first of all, what's your source of information? Where do you get this from?
Absolutely.
Where do you base it on?
Are we codding ourselves anyway? Yeah. Because does having information really give me power? I think we think it does, but it doesn't, because as you say, we're back to the idea of mystery, because mystery is always there.
I think there's a strength in having the courage to actually say, I don't know. And I find that as a parent, to actually be able to say to somebody, you know, to say to one of my kids, I don't know, actually, let's find out. Let's think about that. What do you think? How do you think that might fit or whatever?
And do you know, I was thinking, just even as you were speaking, there's a place, don't you think, in our faith that there are, you know, even the idea of the Trinity, it's almost designed for us to blow our minds.
Yes, that's right.
Because some things are unknowable.
It's so vast. I mean, when you think about the fact that there's literally thousands of libraries all over the world with millions of books trying to explain this one part of God, that he's one God and yet three persons in one God, and each individual and yet all the one. I mean, where do you go with that?
Yeah.
But actually, I think coming back to this sense of, I don't know, there's a lovely story told. I think it's probably apocryphal, but we'll think of it anyway. And that is James Cook, when he went to Australia and one of his trips, and he was meeting some of the Aborigines and they were trying to get to understand each other's language. So he'd point to a tree and he'd say, tree. And then the Aborigines would say, in their language. And then he saw these creatures hopping around the place. And he looked at them and pointed, and the guy said, kangaroo. And so they wrote down kangaroo. Many years later, they realized that kangaroo means, I don't know. That's actually what it actually means. So there are millions of I don't knows bouncing around the place in Australia at
this
very moment.
That's a brilliant story. I've never heard it before. That's so cool. Yeah. Brilliant. Yeah. So it's not okay to know everything then?
Yeah.
It is okay.
It has to be okay, because I mean, like, in this world we can't.
Yeah.
We see through a glass darkly.
Yeah.
You know, we see the shadows of and the sense of things. Even with all our scientific breakthroughs, I mean, it's taken us many, many years to work out the functionings of a hand.
Yeah.
You know, which is wonderful that they can actually do this sensory stuff with a regenerated hand and all that sort of stuff. But that's only one small part of the human body. We haven't even begun to look at how we do brain or ears or all of this sort of stuff. There's so much more that we don't know.
Yeah.
And it's okay.
Yes, it's okay not to know. I was just thinking, you're reminding me of many thousands of years ago when I was in school, and our physics teacher just started to kind of break things down.
Yeah.
And the idea that actually behind everything, there was always a further question. Underneath that, maybe we always find out what's the heart of this, then realize there's something deeper that we don't know about. It's just endless, you know. You never get to the heart of it, and that's the thing. You know?
I get the privilege of going into some schools and talking about God, talking about different subjects for people. But what I actually have been doing recently is going into a fifth class in a local school, and they have so many questions. Every single question generates another 10. It's like this unending circle. But actually, it's fascinating because these kids are actually thinking about things that I wasn't thinking about till I was 16, 17. They're 10, 11, 12. And they're really searching for answers. But this Google age, with this sense of all this information that we should be answers here, why can't this fit into a neat little box? Yeah. And I've broken it down in a way for them to understand that there's proof, there's things we can prove, there's things we can see evidence for, and there's faith.
Yeah.
So we can prove that Jesus existed. There's so many cross-references that you can use. That's a fact of history. There's so much evidence for the resurrection.
Yeah.
It's not proof, but it's evidence. Use your brain and your heart. And then there's so many things we have to start learning by faith, by trust, by heart.
I think at the heart of it, and this is, it's interesting that your 10 and 11 year olds in fifth class are feeling it. There's something about the water that we swim in, you know, the zeitgeist, whatever you want to call it, that thinks that actually everything is kind of knowable.
Yeah, that's right.
And that's really the problem. It's not that we shouldn't have curious minds, because we do, and that's fine.
And we're made with them.
But the idea that, in a way, it's almost like a kind of a divinity of its own, that know everything. It's possible. And that's really a kind of a false God, isn't it?
We've both, exactly, and there's an idolatry built into that, if you think of it, because there's this sense of it being almost mathematical. Everything can be brought back down to some equation or algorithm or some sort of fact.
Yeah.
You know, and that all the time happened is we haven't worked out the answer yet.
Yes.
Now, on one level, that looks good because, I mean, the brain is amazing and human ability to create and develop things is phenomenal. But we are literally only scratching the surface yet. And so it comes back to what you said before. It's that sense of a need of control. I need to understand this. Because if I don't understand it, it becomes frightening. If it becomes frightening, I can't cope with it. And it's just one of the many things I'm frightened of. So suddenly we're unsettled.
Very good. And just as you say it, science hasn't found out the answer yet. No. Is an inherently religious statement.
Yes, it is.
It's a faith statement.
Yeah. And so many scientists have a faith because they know that they are into science and fact and evidence and all of that, but they also know that there's bigger than that.
Absolutely. You know? In a way, it kind of explains to some degree, doesn't it, Baden, the idea that when someone comes to you and they're struggling beyond the need, They kind of want to understand God intellectually, and they ask you questions, as in, give me, within this paradigm, within this notion of intellectualism, within this space, can you prove God to me?
Yeah.
And you have to always say, I can give you a bit, but I can't give you a lot.
Exactly. And I mean, very often, the person who's struggling in that way, and all of us have questions, all of us have doubts at different levels and stages or whatever, but I think the person is really actually looking for is not even so much, it is that sense of, I can't control everything, so I need something I can hold on to, I need tangible. And with God, it's very hard to be tangible. I mean, some of us do get physical expression, manifestations or whatever, but really, most of us are dealing with steps of faith here. That is very hard even to explain to people.
Yeah.
And yes, I know you're talking about the Ecumenical Bible Week and stuff like that.
Yeah.
You know, the whole concept is be prepared in season and out of season.
Yeah.
Think about these things. As Christians, be honest and say to your friends or your children, I actually don't know the answer to that. I'm struggling a bit with that too. Because then it becomes okay for them to wonder and to doubt.
Absolutely. That's lovely. Actually, that is lovely. And in a way, that's kind of, I can hear you saying, I was about to ask you the question, what do you do with somebody who comes through the door and wants all the assurances?
Yeah.
I can almost hear an answer in the middle of that. What would you say to somebody who wants those assurances?
First of all, it's okay to doubt. It's okay to ask questions. God is more than big enough to take them.
Yeah.
And he's more than big enough to understand. He on the cross himself, my God, why have you forsaken me? Had God left him? No. No, but he felt it. He felt that distance, that cut off.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we feel. We feel cut off from the eternal. And we think, where do I go with this? So I think what you say, the first thing to do is for people maybe is just to normalize and say, it's okay. You know, let's talk to God about that. Let's look, what does he say in the Bible? What are the wise heads of Christianity saying about these things? What are the truths that we can hook on to here? One of the things I find in my pastoral ministry is when people are struggling, they don't know whether to trust people, because very often a lot of this is emotional and it's trusting as well. Mm. You know, trusting anybody, never mind God. So it's actually, you know, finding absolutes. And you see, we live in a time when absolutes are kind of like they're a no-go area. Oh, we can't have absolutes. Everybody has different absolutes. Your absolute can't be better than my absolute. There are absolutes that exist whether we believe them or not. Absolute love. You know, God is power. It's absolute power. God can be everywhere at the one single time. You know, I mean, like, you know, like, these are absolutes. Whether we believe them or not, they're there. And I think what is helping people to say is, well, what are the absolutes? What are the things that you can hold on to? You know, and it can be as simple. I've used this analogy once or twice with somebody. How much is 2 plus 2? Well, it's 4, I hope. Shout out to those still doing maths. But it's 4. And yet, how do we know that? How do we know that it's always 4? Because, first of all, somebody's mind came up with this system, a numerical system. But also, it's been proven. We've seen it in school. We've been taught. So it's the same process for us as people of faith, passing that faith on to others, inviting them, not pushing them, but inviting them to come and make their own decisions within it. God is a God of free choice. He wants us to choose to work these things out, head and heart in tandem together.
Beautiful,
it's just a wonderful thing.
Absolutely. Yeah, I was just thinking of the story, you know, like Peter, it's often in the thing we know very well and think we know very well, and then suddenly Jesus goes and pulls thousands of fish where there shouldn't be thousands of fish. And immediately Peter goes, get away from me, I'm sinful, get away from me.
I can't.
And I always feel like that's his moment of, this is mystery, I'm encountering that's mystery, and it's frightening me.
Yeah, that's right. And even within that, and I know it's a slightly different version in the John's Gospel, but when there's 153 fish, that was the number of nations of the world at the time.
Wow.
Even in that, God was actually making a very clear statement that they would have subtly begun to understand as time went on. But yeah, that's right. I mean, it's that sense of the awesomeness and the wonder of God. I mean, like, sometimes you just sit there and think, I mean, what we see around us can really move us, can touch us, can really shake us. But that's only a taste of who God is and what he has and who he is for us and with us. And I think our minds aren't yet ready to grasp
for the fullness
the full
of it.
Mystery of it.
Absolutely. Yeah. So do not be afraid of mystery.
Thanks.
Reverend Baden Stanley from Christchurch in Bray, County Wicklow, thank you so much
for speaking to us
Great this
to
morning.
Thanks for listening to our Spirit Radio podcast. Don't miss out. Subscribe today. Find out how at spiritradio.ie.